Friday, October the 8th. It had been a short night. I left a call for 5 o'clock. The commanding voice of the telephone jarred me awake. I put on my best version, 5 o'clock version, of Eddie Sin's makeup and the bright red Christmas robe that Lyndon had given me years ago. And I woke up Lucy and walked into Lyndon's room with a cup of coffee about 5:40. There followed as interesting a 30 minutes as I'll ever spend. The tableau when I walked in was this. Lyndon lying on the bed, about 12 people, mostly doctors, in green coats and small green caps, and trousers that covered their shoes, and a few nurses standing around him. They were taking an EKG. Dr. Hurst seemed to be pondering the results. Lyndon said, "Do you want me to get Dr. Calvert to come out and help you?" That is sort of a standing joke with us that harks back to 1955. And then he said, "Ken, where is he?" "Off conferring with the Secret Service, I guess." "How many men do they have out there, 8? There was a strange air of detachment, of unreality, about the scene, as though I were the one who had been partially anesthetized. No solemn feeling that my husband was being carted off for major surgery. Bill Moyers and Jack were there. Bill said something about the final vote on the highway improvement bill having been 245 to 138. Lyndon looked at Jack and said, "Reckon old Jack is going to write a book about us?" Bill said, "I know he is. He always has a notebook in his hand." Jack said, "You are not going to come out very well in it if I do, if you keep this up." There was a high sense of theater about the whole thing, and no doubt who was the director. He asked me to come close, and he said, "As soon as this is over, call my family. Call Lucia and Rebecca and Sam Houston and tell them how it went. And call Dr. George Davis. I'd like to have him here when I come out." Lucy came in, and he asked her to read him a poem from her book of poems. She read On Becoming 57. And then he turned to a certain page in the little blue book of prayers that Calvin Thielman had given him and asked her to read that prayer. As she started, he sat up in bed, swung his feet to the floor, and then seemed to crumple. There was one horrifying moment when I thought that he must have been trying to walk to the bathroom, but was dizzy from his first dose of sedative and was falling. But no, he was simply getting down on his knees and on his own power. I have never felt a room more quiet. Lucy, very beautifully and clearly, read the prayer. And then, before I could fully grasp how shaken I was, there was a complete change of pace. Lyndon hauled himself back up into the bed and said, "Reckon old Beagle will want to come out and see me?" And Ken said, "Last time they said we could bring him out, but we would have to boil him first." And all the room convulsed into laughter. Then they wheeled up a long cart, and doctors, corpsmen, everybody assisted Lyndon onto it. And then he said, "Let's go." I felt like cheering. I felt, too, like he was putting on a performance to save us from being worried. It was about 6:15, and Lucy and I went back into our room. About 6:45, I called the Reverend George Davis and got him just as he was walking out the door. He said he was going to come to the hospital and wait. I told him about Lyndon's words, that he'd like to have him there when he woke up, but that he, Lyndon, would not be down from surgery for several hours yet. But Dr. Davis said he wanted to come on anyhow. The surgery began at 7. Dear Jim Kane put his head in the door 3 times in the course of the next 2 or so hours to tell me that everything was going fine, and the last time at 9:15 to say that the operation was ended, very successful. The gallbladder had been just as they suspected, inflamed with 1 stone in it, that they were very glad they got it when they did, that they had also been able to extract the kidney stone from the ureter. This meant a double operation, a longer incision, more hazard, and longer recuperation. But oh, what a blessed relief to know that this other sword of Damocles was also removed. I felt a wave of weariness engulf me in the next few hours. Completely and exquisitely relaxed, talked to Lucia, to Rebecca, to Sam Houston, to Dr. Billy Graham, and to Linda. She, I regret, reached me before I could get to her. Bill Moyers came in. By 10, Lyndon was partially awake, and at 11 had spoken to Bill. John Connolly called. The first, I believe, incoming call, except for Linda's. I was glad that it was from him. But it seemed a long time before Lennon came down from the recuperation room. It was 12 o'clock when they told me that he was back in his room. Lucy and I went in. He was quite gray and stale. Color was the first thing that struck me. And then all of the tubes, some 3 or 4, like a replay of 1955. I sat beside him. He did not say anything, but his hand moved a little. I reached over and took it, and there was a flicker of a smile. Lucy had to leave for class before 1. The afternoon is a montage. I talked to Liz and Bess, learned that the party had gone on at the White House till all hours. I was delighted to hear it, because I had worried about those actors who had given so much, who had not had anything to eat or drink. I had told Liz and Bess earlier that Lennon would go on to the hospital and I would go back to the White House. Cast and guests for merriment and refreshments. But that was before any of us dreamed the show would finish at 11:15. And at that man-killing hour, I had simply fled with Lyndon to the hospital, leaving Liz and Bess to take the initiative, for better or worse, gather up Hubert and Muriel and the cast and go back to the great spread the senators had only made a dent in. A great many of the Congress had come strolling in. The folk singers gave forth, and the handlebar mustached boys shook the chandeliers with the songs about the old lady ninth. Sometime during the afternoon, Lyndon came to enough to ask me to have Liz and Bess write a very special letter to each member of the cast thanking them for his signature. I could have kissed him. I talked to Larry O'Brien to get his evaluation of the temper of the Congress when the Highway Improvements Bill was finally passed. He didn't exactly comfort me. He says, yes, there was bitterness and wounds, but nothing that wouldn't be recovered by January. I was trying to evaluate if I should telephone all the floor leaders, just who I should. Larry suggested I talk to Alan Boyd about whether the amendments passed would really cripple the bill, just what they would mean to it, and what the next step would be. Take it as it was, or have a conference committee between the House and Senate. A little past 6, Linda arrived in the smartest brown and white checkered suit, eyes sparkling, looking beautiful and so attractive. She and her daddy have a nice, flirtatious camaraderie. She resents his determination to make her better groomed, to dress better, and at the same time, she rises to the challenge of it. I talked to Jesse about business at the ranch, and Mary Rather called. I would be lonesome if there were ever a time when Mary didn't call. It is so comforting to have Jim Kane and Willis Hurst within arm's reach, and John and Mary calling. Actually, after 9:30 or so, when Jim had told me the operation was a complete success, I had dissolved into an exquisite state of complete relaxation, even having hot cakes and butter and honey and bacon for breakfast, though little else the rest of the day. And a long nap in the afternoon, a sort of the end of the rope giving up. Linda and I were in and out of Lyndon's room from 6 o'clock on, and then about 9:30, I enjoyed the ultimate luxury of going to bed. The earliest hour in ages.